I saw the Fnords the same day I first heard about the plastic martini. Let me be very clear and precise about this, since many of the people on this trip are deliberately and perversely obscure. I would not, could not, have seen the Fnords if Hagbard Shaleen hadn't hypnotized me the night before on the flying saucer. I had been reading Pat Walsh's memos at home and listening to a new record from the Museum of Natural History. I was adding a few new samples to my collection of Washington Weisthaupt pictures on the wall when the saucer appeared hovering outside my window. Needless to say, it didn't particularly surprise me. I had saved a little of the alm after Chicago, contrary to the instructions from Elf, and had dosed myself. After meeting with the Dalai Lama, not to mention Malaclips the Elder, and seeing that nut Chaleen actually talk to gorillas, I assumed my mind was a point of receptivity where the alm would trigger something truly original. The UFO, in fact, was a bit of a letdown. So many people had seen them already, and I was ready for something nobody had ever seen or imagined. It was even more a disappointment when they psyched me or slurped me aboard, and I found, instead of Martians or insect trust delegates from the Crab Galaxy, just Hagbard, Stella Maris, and a few other people from the Leif Erikson.
"Hail, Eris," said Hagbard.
"All hail Discordia," I replied, giving the 3-after-2 pattern and completing the pentad. "Is this something important, or did you just want to show me your latest invention?" The inside of the saucer was, to be trite, eerie. Everything was non-Euclidean and semi-transparent. I kept feeling that I might fall through the floor and hurtle to the ground to smash myself on the sidewalk. Then we started moving, and it got worse.
"Don't let the architecture disturb you," Hagbard said. "My own adaptation of some of Bucky Fuller's synergetic geometry. It's smaller and more solid than it looks. You won't fall out, believe me."
"Is this contraption behind all the flying saucer reports since 1947? I asked curiously.
"Not quite," Hagbard laughed. "That is basically a hoax. The plan was created in the United States government, one of the few ideas they have had without direct Illuminati inspiration since about the middle of Roosevelt's first term. A reserve measure in case something happens to Russia and China."
"Hi, baby," I said softly to Stella, remembering San Francisco. "Would you tell me, minus the Chilean rhetoric and paradox, what the hell he's talking about?"
"The state is based on threat,"
Stella said simply.
"If people aren't afraid of something, they'll realize they don't need that big government hand picking their pockets all the time. So, in case Russia and China collapse from internal dissension, or get into a private war and blow each other to hell, or suffer some unexpected natural calamity like a series of earthquakes, the saucer myth has been planted. If there are no earthly enemies to frighten the American people with, the saucer myth will immediately change. There will be evidence that they come from Mars and are planning to invade and enslave us. Dig?"
"So," Hagbard added, "I built this little gizmo and I can travel anywhere I want without interference. Any sighting of this craft, whether by a radar operator with 20 years' experience or a little old lady in Perth Amboy, is regarded by the government as a case of auto-suggestion, since they know they didn't plant it themselves. I can hover over cities like New York or military installations that are top secret or any place I damn well please. Nice?"
"Very nice," I said. "But why did you bring me up here?"
"It's time for you to see the Fnords," he replied.
Then I woke up in bed, and it was the next morning. I made breakfast in a pretty nasty mood, wondering if I'd seen the Fnords, whatever the hell they were, in the hours he had blacked out, or if I would see them as soon as I went out in the street. I had some pretty gruesome ideas about them, I must admit. Creatures with 3 eyes and tentacles, survivors from Atlantis who walked among us, invisible due to some form of mind shield, and did hideous work for the Illuminati. It was unnerving to contemplate, and I finally gave in to my fears and peeked out the window, thinking it might be better to see them from a distance first. Nothing. Just ordinary, sleepy people heading for their buses and subways. That calmed me a little, so I set out the toast and coffee and fetched in the New York Times from the hallway. I turned the radio to WBAI and caught some good Vivaldi, sat down, grabbed a piece of toast, and started skimming the first page. Then I saw the Fnords. The feature story involved another of the endless squabbles between Russia and the U.S. in the UN General Assembly. And after each direct quote from the Russian delegate, I read a quite distinct fnord. The second lead was about a debate in Congress on getting the troops out of Costa Rica. Every argument presented by Senator Bacon was followed by another fnord. At the bottom of the page was a Times depth-type study of the growing pollution problem and the increasing use of gas masks among New Yorkers. The most distressing chemical facts were interpolated with more fnords. Suddenly, I saw Hagbard's eyes burning into me and heard his voice.
Your heart will remain calm. Your adrenaline gland will remain calm. Calm all over. Calm. You will not panic. You will look at the fnord and see it. You will not evade it or black it out. You will stay calm and face it.
And further back, way back, my first grade teacher writing fnord on the blackboard, while a wheel with a spiral design turned and turned on his desk, turned and turned, and his voice droned on.
If you don't see the fnord, it can't eat you. Don't see the fnord. Don't see the fnord.
I looked back at the paper and still saw the fnords. This was one step beyond Pavlov, I realized. The first conditioned reflex was to experience the panic reaction, the activation syndrome it's technically called, whenever encountering the word fnord. The second conditioned reflex was to black out what happened, including the word itself, and just to feel a general low-grade emergency without knowing why. And the third step, of course, was to attribute this anxiety to the news stories, which were bad enough in themselves anyway. Of course, the essence of control is fear. The fnords produced a whole population walking around in chronic low-grade emergency, tormented by ulcers, dizzy spells, nightmares, heart palpitations, and all the other symptoms of too much adrenaline. All my left-wing arrogance and contempt for my countrymen melted, and I felt genuine pity. No wonder the poor bastards believe anything they're told, walk through pollution and overcrowding without complaining, watch their sons hauled off to endless wars and butchered, never protest, never fight back, never show much happiness or eroticism or curiosity or normal human emotion, live with perpetual tunnel vision, walk past a slum without seeing either the human misery it contains or the potential threat it poses to their security. Then I got a hunch and turned quickly to the advertisements. It was as I expected. No fnords. That was part of the gimmick, too. Only in consumption, endless consumption, could they escape the amorphous threat of the invisible fnords. I kept thinking about it on my way to the office. If I pointed out a fnord to somebody who hadn't been deconditioned, as Hagbard deconditioned me, what would he or she say? They'd probably read the word before or after it. No, this word, I'd say. And they would again read an adjacent word. But would their panic level rise as the threat came closer to consciousness? I preferred not to try the experiment. It might have ended with a psychotic fugue in the subject. The conditioning, after all, went back to grade school. No wonder we all hate those teachers so much. We have a dim, masked memory of what they've done to us in converting us into good and faithful servants for the Illuminati. When I arrived at my desk, Peter Jackson handed me a press release.
What do you make of this?
He asked with a puzzled frown, and I looked at the mimeographed first page. The old eye and pyramid design leaped out at me. Demolay Frères invite you to the premiere debut of the world's first plastic nude martini, the press release declared. On second glance, the eye in the triangle turned into the elliptical rim of a martini glass, while the pupil in the eye was actually the olive floating in the cocktail.
What the hell is a plastic nude martini?
Said Peter Jackson.
And why would they invite us to a press party for one?
You can bet that it's non-biodegradable, said Joe.
Which will make it very unfashionable with honky ecology freaks,
said Peter sarcastically.
Joe squinted at the design again. It could be a coincidence,
But coincidence was just another word for synchronicity.
I think I'll go,
he said.
And what's that?
He added, as his eye fell upon a half-unfolded poster on his desk.
Oh, that came with the latest American Medical Association album, said Peter. I don't want it, and I thought you might. It's time you took those pictures of the Rolling Stones off your wall. This is the age of constantly accelerating change, and a man who displays old pictures of the Stones is liable to be labeled a reactionary.
Four owl-eyed faces stared at him. They were dressed in one-piece white suits, and three of them were joining extended hands to form a triangle, while the fourth, Wolfgang Sauer, generally acknowledged to be the leader of the group, stood with his arms folded in the center. The picture was taken from above so that the most prominent elements were the four heads, while the outstretched arms clearly made the sides of the triangle, and the bodies seemed unimportant, dwindling away to nothing. The background was jet black. The three young men and the woman, with their smooth-shaven, bony faces, their blonde crew cuts, and their icy blue eyes, seemed extremely sinister to Joe. If the Nazis had won the war and Heinrich Himmler had followed Hitler as the ruler of the German Empire, kids like this would be running the world. And they almost were, in a different sense, because they had succeeded the Beatles and Stones as kings of music, which made them emperors among youth. Although long hair remained the general fashion, the kids had accepted the American Medical Association's antiseptic clean appearance as a needed reaction against a style that had become too commonplace. As Wolfgang himself had said,
"If you need an outward sign to know your own, you don't really belong."
"They give me the creeps," said Joe.
"What did you think when the Beatles first came out?" said Peter.
Joe shrugged. "They gave me the creeps. They looked ugly and sexless and like teenage werewolves with all that hair, and they seemed to be able to mesmerize 12-year-old girls."
Peter nodded.
"The bulk of the AMA's fans are even younger. You might want to start conditioning yourself to them now. They're going to be around for a long time."
"Peter, let's you and me have lunch," Joe said. "Then I'm going to get some work done, and then I'm going to leave here at 4 to go to this plastic martini party. First of all, though, hold the chair for me while I take down the stones and put up the American Medical Association."
The De Molay Frere group wasn't kidding, he found. There were martinis, olives and all, or cocktail onions for those who preferred them, in transparent plastic bags that were shaped like nude women. Pretty terrible taste the manufacturer had, thought Joe. Briefly, Joe wondered if it would be a good idea to infiltrate this company so as to get dosages of Om in all the plastic nude martinis. But then he remembered the emblem and thought maybe this company was already infiltrated. But by which side? There was a beautiful Oriental girl in the room. She had black hair that reached all the way down to the small of her back, and when she raised her arms to adjust a head ornament, Joe was surprised to see thick black hair in her armpits.
"Orientals did not normally have much body hair," he thought. "Could she be some relation to the hairy Ainu of northern Japan?"
It intrigued him, turned him on as he never thought armpit hair would, and he went over to her to talk. The first thing he noticed was that the headband she wore had a golden apple with the letter K printed right on it in the center of her forehead.
"She is one of us," he thought.
His hunch about coming to this party was right.
"These martini bags sure have a silly shape," said Joe.
"Why, don't you care for nude women?"
"Well, this has about as much to do with nude women as any other piece of plastic," said Joe. "Now, my point is that it's in such execrable taste. But then all of American industry is nothing but a giant obscene circus to me. What's your name?"
The black eyes fixed his intently.
"Mao Zuxi."
"Any relation?"
"No, my name means cat in Chinese. His doesn't. His name is Mao, but mine is Mao."
Joe was enchanted by the enunciation of the two different tones.
"Well, Miss Cat, you are the most attractive woman I've met in ages."
She responded with a silent flirtation of her own, and they were soon in a wonderfully interesting conversation, which he could never remember afterwards, nor did he notice the pinch of powder she dropped into his drink. He began feeling strangely groggy. Sushi took his arm and led him to the check room. They got their coats, left the building, and hailed a cab. In the back seat, they kissed for a long time. She opened her coat, and he pulled the zipper that went all the way down the front of her dress. He felt her breasts and stroked her belly, then dropped his head into her bush. She was wearing no underwear. She draped her legs over his, using her coat to screen what was going on from the cab driver, and helped him expose his erect penis.
With a few quick, agile movements, she had swept her skirt out of the way, raised her little seat into the air, and slid her well-lubricated cunt down over his cock and was fucking him side-saddle. It could have been difficult and awkward, but she was so light and well-coordinated that she managed to bring herself to orgasm easily and voluptuously. She drew in her breath sharply through her teeth, and a shudder ran through her body. She rested her head momentarily on his shoulder, then raised herself slightly and helped Joe to a pleasant climax with a rotary motion of her ass. The experience, Joe realized, would have been more exquisite a few months or a few years earlier. Now, with his growing sensitivity, he was conscious of what had been missing, the actual energetic contact. The effect of the jams and the discordians on him, he reflected, had been paradoxical by ordinary standards. He was no more puritanical than before they started tinkering with his nervous system, he was less, but at the same time, casual sex was less appealing to him. He remembered Atlanta Hope's diatribes against sexism in her book Telemachus Sneezed, the Bible of the God's Lightning Movement, and he suddenly saw some weird kind of sense in her rantings. The sexual revolution in America was as much of a fraud as the political revolutions in China and Russia, Atlanta had written with her usual exuberant capitalization. She was, in a way, quite right. People today were still wrapped in a cellophane of false ego, and even if they fucked and had orgasms together, the cellophane was still there, and no real contact had been made. And yet, if Mao was what he suspected, she would know this even better than he did. Was this quick, cool spasm some kind of test or some lesson or demonstration? If so, how was he supposed to respond? And then he remembered that she had not given an address to the driver. The cab had been waiting only for them, to take them to a predetermined place, for reasons unknown.
"I've seen the Fenords," he thought. "Now I'm going to see more."
The cab stopped on a narrow, heavily shadowed street that seemed to be all empty stores, factory buildings, loading docks, and warehouses. With Miss Mao leading, they entered an old, dilapidated-looking loft building, with the aid of a key she had in her handbag, climbed some clanging cast-iron stairs, walked hand in hand down a long, dark corridor, and came at last, through a series of anterooms, each better appointed than the last, to a splendid boardroom. Joe shook his head, amazed at what he saw, but there was something, he suspected a drug, that was keeping him docile and passive. Around a table sat men and women, costumed from various eras of human history. Joe recognized Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Mongol, and Polynesian dress, also classical Greek and Roman, medieval and Renaissance. There were other outfits more difficult to recognize at first glance. A Flying Dutch board meeting, Joe thought to himself. They were talking about the Illuminati, the Discordians, the Jams, and the Arisians. A man wearing a steel breastplate and helmet with gold inlay and a neatly trimmed mustache and goatee said,
"It is now possible to predict with 98% probability of accuracy that the Illuminati are setting up Fernando Poo for an international crisis. The question is, do we raid the island and get the records now, making sure they're not endangered, or do we wait and take advantage of the trouble as a cover for our raid?"
A man in a dragon-embroidered red silk robe said,
"There will be no way to take advantage of the trouble, in my opinion. It will seem like chaos on the surface, but underneath, the Illuminati will have everything very much under control. Now is the time to move."
A woman in a translucent silk blouse, whose little vest did not hide her dark, rounded breasts, said,
"You realize this could be a lovely scoop for your magazine, Mr. Malik. You could send a reporter there to look into conditions on Fernando Poo. Equatorial Guinea has all the usual problems of a developing African nation. Will tribal rivalries flare up between the booby and the fang, preventing the further development of national cooperation? Will the poverty of the mainland province lead to attempts to expropriate the wealth of Fernando Poo? And what of the army? What, for example, of a certain Captain Jesus Tequila Imota? An interview with the captain might prove to be a journalistic coup 3 years from now."
"Yes,"
said a big woman in colorfully dyed furs who played incessantly with the carved leg bone of some large animal.
"We don't expect C.L. Sulzberger to grasp the importance of Fernando Poo until the crisis is upon the world. So, if advance warning is desirable, and we think it is, why not through confrontation?"
Is that why you asked me here?
Said Joe.
To tell me something is going to happen in Fernando Poo? Where the hell is Fernando Poo anyway?
Look it up in an atlas when you get back to work. It's one of several volcanic islands off the coast of Africa,
said a dark-skinned, slit-eyed man wearing a buffalo hide decorated with feathers.
Of course you understand that you could only hint at the real forces of work there,
he added.
For instance, we wouldn't want you to mention that Fernando Poo is one of the last outcroppings of the continent of Atlantis, you know?
Mao Sushi was standing beside Joe with a glass containing a pinkish liquid.
Here, drink this,
she said.
It will sharpen your perceptions.
A man in a gold-braid-encrusted field marshal's uniform said,
Mr. Malik, is the next business in order on our agenda? We are to educate him to some extent. Let's do it to that extent.
The lights in the room went out. There was a rustling at one end, and suddenly Joe was looking at a brightly lit movie screen.